Before us is number 17-6034, Husky Ventures versus B55 Investments. Counsel for appellant, would you make your appearance?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Steve Shoyagi, and I represent the appellants who are the defendants in the underlying case, and they are B55 and Mr. Christopher MacArthur. Here at counsel table is Marissa Hudson-Arney, who is with me on the briefs. Before, you saw a lot in the briefing about the Oklahoma statute, the civil liability statute. And before we get there, because that, of course, is the major piece that we have in this appeal, I'd like to spend a couple minutes, if I may, on the contract issue. This is the contract interpretation issue, which is subject to a de novo standard of review. It was more further on in the brief, but I wanted to comment on it before we get to the civil liability statute. The contract interpretation issue is a major one. It is what started the parties getting crosswise with themselves with each other in the first place. And that is their understanding of how the legal relationship would proceed with respect to the advanced leasing program. So Husky's position, as you've seen in the brief, is that once an investor such as B55 signs onto their program, Husky would refer them to paragraph 12 of the participation agreements. Husky would, and the practice was, that Husky would just send them bills. The bills didn't necessarily have the leases in them. They didn't have the backup for what was being spent. There was nothing in the bills that said what you're buying into. Okay? And Husky's reading of paragraph 12, and this is the dispute, was that either you pay that bill or you're out, and you can't take part in any future leasing that we do in this area that we've identified in the participation agreement. My client's view of this is very different and is based on paragraph 18. Paragraph 18, it doesn't say this is a take-it-or-leave-it basis. Paragraph 18 includes words like, it says things that Husky shall offer the interest. An offer, of course, implies an offer and an acceptance, not take it or leave it. It says, if and when approved by B55. It says that B55 shall have the option to elect to take part. So B55's view of how the advanced leasing program should work has always been based on that language.
Has it always been based on that language? Didn't you pay for 2 or 3 months without questioning and basically under the protocol, the rule of the paragraph 12?
They did.
Then how is it always your view that you should have had a right to approve it ahead of time?
Because those first few months, frankly, the oil and gas business was still doing well, and they didn't have any basis to start looking at it more closely. What happened is the market changed, and
that shouldn't change the terms of the contract, right?
It doesn't change the terms of the contract. It was a business decision to take part blindly, at least for the beginning of the relationship. But that doesn't change the fact that their view always was that they could take part in these leases on a lease by lease basis.
What you recited language in paragraph 18 that is different than language in paragraph 12, but isn't there an argument, of course, that Husky makes that it's different because they're dealing with different situations? In paragraph 18, they're not dealing with situations that fall within the AMI that your client had the opportunity to conduct reasonable diligence and determine that that was all right, that anything within the scope of that in terms of leasing would be something that was acceptable to them. Paragraph 18 deals with a different factual scenario, doesn't it?
I'm familiar with Husky's argument, Your Honor.
Yes.
What I would say is there is no language in paragraph 18 that actually says that.
It defines a different area. We're talking about an area that's both in and outside the AMI, right? And it uses language like designated area. I think it's in here somewhere. I mean, that's different language than is in paragraph 12, right?
It, And I guess the point I'm making, Your Honor, is there, and I've read this many, many times. I'm sure you have as well.
I have, and I'm looking at it.
It doesn't say, and I've been looking for it, it doesn't say that paragraph 18 only applies to the situation where land falls both inside and outside the AMI.
Let's flip it then. It does say subject only to the specific to the specific terms of this agreement to the contrary, subject only to, which means that it's subject to other specific terms of the contract. And hence, paragraph 12, right?
And then if you read on,
yes,
it also says notwithstanding foregoing. So that notwithstanding language is also in there after the subject to language. And it says notwithstanding the foregoing. Let me flip to it, and it starts using the authorize approved type language again after the notwithstanding proviso. And Your Honor, you are pointing out exactly the problem that we have with this paragraph. This is a document that's drafted by Husky. Obviously, we have our view of it. Husky has their view of it. But taking into consideration these two paragraphs next to each other, this is not a clear document at all. And that being the case, we think that the document should be construed against the drafter, which is Husky. Unless there's other questions about that topic, I'd like to move on to what I think is the elephant in the room here. That is the several liability statute. November of 2011, Oklahoma state law changed. The state law in Oklahoma used to allow joint and several liability to be imposed. The new statute, so it's 23 Oklahoma statute annotated section 15, abolished joint and several liability in the state of Oklahoma, period. The statute itself, the language it's very short. But the statute itself it contains no exceptions to
based on
several
fault.
Liability.
It's
based
very
on
clear.
Fault.
Based
right.
on fault, that's the key language here. And
that is the key language.
And we don't have a definition of the term of fault.
There is that's
as far as we know under the Oklahoma statutes, that's why we're here.
That's why we're here. And which is why.
And you've got fault generally, certainly in many cases, refers to negligence. And not intentional torts, as we have here.
Right, I see.
And
right.
You're trying to overcome a plain error standard here, as the district court outlined. I'm struggling to see how you get to plain error on this.
My points are very simple on that, Your Honor. It doesn't say intentional torts. It says fault. And so it is the way I read the statute. Based on fault and not arising out of contract. When you compare and contrast those phrases, we're talking about tort situations and contract situations. It doesn't say based on intentional fault.
The problem is we could be. And certainly many courts would have read that provision based on fault not to deal with intentional faults and specifically exclude them.
It's a major struggle that we all have in this one, of course.
Well, it's plain error. It's plain error.
And I will also say about the plain error standard that I wish I was the attorney there at the trial. That is our uphill battle, and I recognize that.
Well, do you have any case law interpretation of the statute that sheds any light, legislative history?
We have very much legislative history, which I was about to touch on. The case law on the statute is very light. What I'll say is there is no other case from any Oklahoma court or any federal court is imposed joint and several liability. So the one we saw in district court is the first and only. Okay. The other flip side is there's very little case law on the statute at all. But since you asked about it, Your Honor, the legislative history, I think, in this case is right on point, and that is, first of all, There was an earlier draft of this statute. The earlier draft of the statute, and it's in our brief, and I think I redlined what it looked like. The earlier draft had that exception for intentional torts that you were talking about. It was deleted.
Well, it didn't actually say intentional torts, didn't it? Use, as the district court said, willful language regarding willful. It could have been referring to punitive damages, actually.
Right. I think it used
That's
recklessness.
That's not clear either. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. The way I read that, I don't intend to mislead. The way I read that is to be the intentional tort exception. Okay? Because I think historically, black letter law, that's how we would have talked about an intentional tort exception in that statute. The point is, it was removed. And I think that is that is telling us what the intent of the drafters was.
Could it have been removed because they thought that the language based on fault actually resolved the issue and they didn't need the superfluous language?
I don't think so. But
plain
there's,
error.
Right, plain error. There's nothing in the legislative history that addressed that specific question. What we do also know from the legislative history is the Oklahoma State Legislator, and his name escapes me as I stand here today, but he the drafter of the statute, is quoted on the record saying, this is a cross-the-board elimination of joint and several liability. There's no talk about, in the legislative history, any other exceptions to this statute.
I guess I'm struggling with how, if we even have to get to legislative history to try to interpret what would be an ambiguous statute, then how do you have plain error? How can it be plain, even if the legislative history was extremely clear and supported you as you argue it does?
I would go back to the point I made earlier, and I don't. My point is, the statute, the way I read it, plainly in my mind at least, talks about torts versus contracts. It doesn't talk about different types of torts. I wish I had a better answer, but that's the best we can do.
How are you prejudiced? That's the third prong of plain error. Well, how are you prejudiced by the giving of this instruction? The court's premise was that there's no space or daylight between Mr. MacArthur and B-55. So how are you prejudiced by this anyway?
It's a major prejudice, Your Honor. And that would be, first of all, you have to remember there's a $4 million damages award, and there's a $2 million punitive damages award that was against Mr. MacArthur individually. If the jury had been instructed, I think properly, to allocate, how do we know that there would have been even $2 million against Mr. MacArthur that would have supported a punitive damages award? I'll give you another
example.
How
do we know to the contrary?
How do we know
that becomes speculative, and speculation is not the basis for prejudice.
Well, let me give you another example. So there is a joint and several damages award against, of course, the entity too, B-55. Let's assume that there was no damages and it was all allocated to Mr. MacArthur, and we can assume that, I think, fairly, because there was punitive damages against him. Let's just take that hypothetical. What has happened since the trial is Husky has stopped paying B-55 monies that are due under its investment. Its position is it has a judgment. And because there is a judgment against B-55, who is the investor, we're going to stop paying him. So if the jury had been instructed, and the jury really hated Chris MacArthur, and they hit him with the $4 million and the $2 million, B-55 would still be getting paid under the participation agreement that it entered into with Husky. That's a major prejudice.
Of course, none of that's in the record. We would be speculating because based on what you just told us. Post-trial.
You're right about that. I'm not sure how I would fix that in the history, but there you go.
Let me ask you about the compensatory damages award. What's your response to the notion that that's waived? I mean, that you didn't raise a 50A, you didn't raise a 50B. It's challenging the sufficiency of the evidence as it relates to the compensatory damages award. Why is that even before us properly?
I saw that in the briefing. I just caught that when I was going over things. I'm not sure where they came up with that, because our post-trial motion did challenge the damages. It was at the end. It was very brief, very short, but it was there. In fact, I can get you a case citation on that one.
Well, don't waste time on that. I'll find it if it's in the record.
Yeah, it's in the appellate record. It's in our motion. It's literally the last, I think, argument that was in that brief.
This is your 50B motion?
Yeah.
What about your 50A motion, which you needed to raise the same issue, right?
You're right. I think we designated it as a 50B, but we did challenge the damages issue.
In the
single motion that was filed,
okay,
I think we called it a 50B.
Okay, but procedurally, two motions had to be filed to preserve that issue, right?
I honestly don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
I see I don't have very much time left. I was going to reserve, if I may, the last 15 seconds, minute.
You can do that.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. I'm Shannon Stevenson on behalf of the appellee Husky Ventures. Your Honors, the defendants here are asking this Court to let them redo a six-day jury trial based on arguments that were never even mentioned until after the jury rendered its verdict. Besides being untimely, the defendants have failed to identify an error that even occurred here, much less an error that would warrant a retrial in this case. Subject to the Court's questions, I would like to focus my time today on the threshold jurisdictional issue that this Court raised, whether the District Court erred when they did not instruct the jury to apportion damages between the two defendants, and the sufficiency of evidence with respect to the damages verdict that the jury returned.
And let's talk about the jurisdictional issue, which you didn't raise that. We raised that. And so it leads me to a question, really, whether you thought there was any notice issue at all relative to their ability to challenge the motion for new trial disposition.
Your Honor, that's correct. We didn't raise it, and this rule was a surprise to me. The Court did raise it, and subject matter jurisdiction is not waivable, so I do think the Court has to consider it and determine whether it has jurisdiction here. And as the Court noted, Rule 4 is clear. If you're going to challenge the post-trial order, you need to file an amended notice or a new notice of appeal from that order.
Subject matter jurisdiction is not waivable, but part of the calculus in determining whether there was a functional equivalent of the notice of appeal is whether you were prejudiced by, in the sense that you didn't have notice that they were actually going to challenge that. And so looking at the record, there's at least an arguable functional equivalent of a notice of appeal in their motion to certify. So why don't you talk about whether you had a functional equivalent before you and whether you had notice of it.
So, Your Honor, I don't think that Rule 4 actually permits an inquiry into whether there was prejudice or whether there was functional equivalent of a notice.
Smith versus Berry, Supreme Court case. No functional equivalent of a notice of appeal can be filed. Part of determining that analysis is whether the other party was prejudiced, whether they didn't have notice that actually the intent of the appellant was to, in fact, appeal. So, yeah, I think so. That is the law. And therefore, we've got one document. I'm not saying that it's sufficient. I'm just asking you. You had a motion to certify. It talked about challenge that the result of it prevailing would be a new trial. Do you have anything to say about that?
Your Honor, what I would point to is that the notice of appeal that was filed here specifically referenced the judgment and nothing else. It didn't even anticipate, it didn't say, and any denial of any post-trial motions that would occur
counsel,
in the future.
Counsel, didn't the challenge to the judgment, well, let me back up. The issues that we're talking about on this jurisdiction question are issues about matters that occurred at the trial, pre-judgment. There was a proper notice of appeal as to the judgment. And so why can't that serve as a functional preservation of those issues?
This is what I think the question here boils down to. It's, should this court reframe the arguments that the appellant has made here, which are all framed as issues arising from denial of the court's post-trial order, post-trial motion. That's how they chose to frame all of their issues. And the question is, should this court reframe their arguments as though they had appealed directly from the judgment?
At this issue, we don't look how they framed them in their brief. We're looking at the notice of appeal, and they appealed from the judgment.
That is correct. And so I think what they're arguing is, yes, our appeal was just from the judgment. We didn't file the separate notice of appeal that was required by Rule 4, but we're asking you, court, to let us go forward anyway because we could have raised these issues from the judgment.
Well, and that's true with respect to the instructions, correct?
That's true. So what they're asking you to do, though, I think, is reframe their issues as though they had done that. And I would encourage this court not to do that for two reasons. First, I don't think it's your burden to do. In their briefing, they framed their issues as appeals from the post-trial order. And they attach standards of review to that, and they used material that was put into the record after the judgment had been entered. And I don't think this court should take it upon itself to sort through and figure out, well, how would this argument have looked had it been made as a direct appeal from the judgment?
And in your briefing, you refer to that decision as being strategic. And it's not clear to me why that's strategic, because whether they had challenged these alleged errors vis-a-vis the judgment as opposed to the motion for new trial, the plain error, they'd still get plain error. I mean, it's not like they gain any advantage by that I'm aware of by framing their issue as a motion for new trial challenge. Why was this strategic?
Well, I think they added a lot of material to the record, obviously, in their post-trial briefing, including references to, like, for instance, the escrow money. That was something that was never in the record prior to the judgment. And that's just one example. But I think what this highlights is that certainly in a different case, you could have all kinds of different things that arise post-judgment that change the standard of review, that introduce new factual material into the record. And I think it's an easy, bright-line rule to say, we're going to look at how the party itself chose to argue its issues in its appeal. And here, they chose to argue them as an appeal from the post-trial order, not from the judgment. And I think that's what the court should go with and say, if you're going to argue issues as appeals from the post-trial order, then you're going to have filed a notice of appeal consistent with that, and they did not do that here.
So at least one salient thing that they gained under your strategic rubric would be the ability to rely on things post-judgment.
Correct, Your
Honor. Okay.
Can I ask you a question about one of the issues that I think you would agree is preserved, and that's on the permanent injunction. Mm-hmm. How did Husky meet its burden to show that money damages would be inadequate for potential future harm?
Right. Well, what the district court said here, Your Honor, is that Mr. MacArthur and B-55, the defendants, had been engaged in a lengthy pattern, including throughout the entire lawsuit, where they were very transparent and forthright about their intention to destroy the business of Husky. This was replete throughout the record, throughout Mr. MacArthur's many written communications, throughout his own testimony and what Mr. Long from Husky testified that Mr. MacArthur said to him. He was very strangely forthcoming about the fact that this was his intent. And based on that evidence, the district court said it seems there's a significant risk that if there is not a permanent injunction here, that Mr. MacArthur is going to continue this pattern of conduct until Husky's business is destroyed. And we've cited numerous cases to the court showing that destruction of a business is one of the sort of prototypical types of damage that cannot be compensated with money damages. And that's why the permanent injunction was appropriate here. Let me turn now, if I may, to the issue of the jury instructions on apportionment of damages. And again, I'll reiterate, this is indisputably subject to a plain error standard. There is no, and this is an incredibly high bar. We could not find a published civil case from this court where plain error had ever been applied in a civil context. And here, at a baseline, there simply was no error made by the district court in giving the instruction that it gave and in not instructing the jury to apportion, because there was no evidence in the record that would have allowed the jury to apportion. Neither in the district court nor in this appeal have the defendants ever pointed to a single shred of evidence that would have supported a basis to apportion. And in that situation, not only was it not error for the district court to not instruct the jury to apportion, it would have been error if the district court had instructed them to do so. The district court cannot give instructions that are unsupported by evidence in the record. And so he did exactly the right thing here. Coming to the next point.
Well, let me make sure I understand that. Is implicit in what you just said that B-55 and Mr. MacArthur are one and the same?
Your Honor, that was what the court said. He said, I see no evidence in the record that shows that B-55 ever acted not through someone other than Mr. MacArthur, or that Mr. MacArthur was ever acting other than through B-55 or in his representative capacity of B-55.
Is he the sole owner of B-55?
Mr. MacArthur, I don't believe he is the sole owner. I believe what the district court said was he was the sole actor with respect to the conduct in this case. And again, B-55 and the defendants never contradicted this. And I point the court to the employer's reinsurance case And that case is talking about plain error and says one of the factors that the court looks at is what kind of opportunity the party had to raise the issue in the district court. And I just want to make sure the court knows how many opportunities the defendants had to raise this issue in the district court. They had two chances to submit jury instructions of their own. They submitted no instruction on this. The court gave them the specific, explained to them, this is what I'm going to do with respect to this issue because I don't see any evidence to the contrary. What do you guys think? And the defendants clearly said, we have no objection to that. They then had two more opportunities over the next 2 days to review drafts of the jury instructions, and they raised no objection. And they made no argument about this issue in their closing argument, and for good reason, because there was no evidence in the record to support that argument. And so, again, here, there simply cannot be error in not giving an instruction where there is no evidence to support that instruction.
Speaking of instruction, let me ask about the jury instruction related to where the alleged omission is the exclusion of language about you can't interfere with your own business relationship. I understand your position that the Wolfspeck reference to business relationship was dicta, but let's assume for the moment it's not dicta. What's your best argument for why, in fact, these were not B-55's business relationships that it was interfering with?
Well, let's start with the obvious fact that B-55 and Mr. MacArthur had no contract with Gastar. They had no contract with Lemonyan. They had no contract with Torchlight. So that's the first step.
Weren't their interests, though, tied to them in the sense that they were participating in the same projects?
No, and this is important, Your Honor. The primary acts of Mr. MacArthur and B-55 to take down Husky were this. They went to Lemonyan to have Lemonyan record the liens. And with the purpose of that, once those liens were recorded, Gastar could then remove Husky as the operator. All of that activity took place with respect to the Chisholm Trail project. That was a project in which B-55 had no interest. They had those liens recorded on wells in which they had no interest, and they had Gastar remove Husky as that project. And again, B-55 was not a participant with respect to any of that. So no, they didn't have a business relationship even in the most tangential sense. They were merely a participant in other unrelated projects.
When you say they, you're talking about B-55.
Correct, Your Honor.
Why? But Husky did have a business relationship with these other entities.
Husky did. That's correct.
Right. And the claim is interference with those business relationships.
Correct.
And so I guess I'm still wondering why that isn't enough.
Well, the argument that the defendants have made here is that they shouldn't have been subject to tortious interference because they were interfering with their own contractual relationship or business relationship. So, yes, they were certainly interfering with relationships that Husky had with other people, but B-55 was not interfering with its own contractual relationship because it didn't have a contract with any of these parties. And with respect to this conduct...
So are you saying that it's because the claim was narrowed to only those situations that B-55 was part of the business relationship? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think there's two points. The first is along the lines of what you said, which is the primary allegations here that were argued in closing argument about what the interference was forcing getting Lemonyan to record the liens and getting Gastar to remove Husky as the operator at Chisholm Trail. Again, that's a project that B-55 has no interest in whatsoever.
Was there no interference relative to the Prairie Grove project or the Viking project?
I believe that there was some evidence put on about that at trial. But again, those weren't the fundamental allegations that ended up being argued at the end of the day. And even with respect to those, Your Honor, you're still talking about a very tangential relationship. That the facts there would be that B-55 and Gastar happened to both be participants in the same project. And I think that is not sufficient to be the same business relationship for purposes of tortious interference. And I would caution the court, if you started to go down that path of viewing it that broadly, you would start to foreclose a tremendous number of tortious interference claims because it will almost always be true that the party that's interfering is going to have some relationship to the business at hand. And again, let me just take one step back here. Again, we're on a plain error standard. Certainly there is no well-settled, clear and obvious law that would apply to govern the business relationship allegation that the defendants have made in this case. And so regardless of how the court were to look at the merits of the instruction, it's absolutely not plain error. With my last few seconds, I did want to just point the court to some important evidence with respect to the damages. And, Your Honor, I want to also note on your waiver question, they did raise it in their Rule 50B, but not in their Rule 50A. So, again, that issue is waived for failure to raise it in the 50A. But if you look to Plaintiff's Exhibit 1, Mr. MacArthur here clearly laid out what his plan was with respect to forcing LaMunyon or getting LaMunyon to record these liens. He says that it was his doing to make that happen, and that was his plan all along. And that is plenty of evidence on causation. Thank you, and we request that you affirm.
Thank you, counsel. Better make it good. 12 seconds.
We're on the rocket. Two quick points. They sued us for breach of contract and for tortious interference with contract and business relationship. So we have an interest in a participation agreement. The participation agreement allows people to have an interest in each well. Each well has a joint operating agreement. So an investor has an interest in a well. That is the business relationship. That's my first point. Second, briefly, we've seen this before, that there was no evidence in the record that would allow a jury to apportion damages. Let's not forget, that's not my client's burden. It is Husky's burden to tell the jury who did what when and how to apportion damages in their opinion. They didn't do it. So we can't be tricked by this little burden shift here of trying to tell the jury, tell the court that there's no way to make that distinction.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Case is submitted.